Eleanor LaCane. The 2016 presidential race is a real horse race and truly amazing. Hillary Clinton will be the first woman presidential nominee of a major party in history. She's facing off against Republican Donald Trump, the blatantly anti-immigrant, racist misogynist. Bernie Sanders, the first openly Democratic socialist candidate to run seriously in 100 years, beat all expectations in getting votes and raising money, and can play a key role not only in this election, but in shaping the Democratic Party for years to come. The presidential race is a battle over who we are as Americans, and indeed over the future of America. We face important questions. Can Donald Trump be stopped? Will the Democrats unite behind the nominee and turn out to vote in November to beat Trump and win the White House? Will the Democrats be able to win a majority of the Senate to keep President Trump in check or to pass legislation with President Hillary Clinton? What will the Sanders supporters do in this election and beyond? Here to help us understand all this and what it means is Harold Meyerson, one of the country's leading political analysts. Harold Meyerson is editor-at-large of the American Prospect, one of the top political magazines in the country. For the past 13 years, he has written a weekly op-ed column for the Washington Post. Previously, he was executive editor of the LA Weekly, the nation's largest metropolitan weekly. His articles on politics, labor, the economy, foreign policy, and American culture have also appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New Republic, The Nation, The New York Times, and many other publications. Harold Meyerson, welcome back to All Together Now.
All good things. I'm glad I'm here, Eleanor.
Good. Well, let's first talk about the fact that the Attorney General recently accepted the recommendation of the FBI to not press charges against Hillary Clinton about her email server. How damaged do you think she is by this whole email server issue? The FBI gave a scolding, but no charges.
Yeah, well, you know, the question is this going to affect the votes of people who already are determined, people who aren't already determined not to vote for Hillary? And you know, if she was running against someone other than Donald Trump, I would I'd be very concerned. But she's not. She's running against Donald Trump. I mean, the latest story I just saw, just posted on the Washington Post website, is Trump met today with Republican senators and, you know, had a fight with, you know, I mean, a verbal fight with several of them. I mean, Trump has a way of eclipsing, you know, Democratic bad news. It is in his nature to do this. Does it help her? No. Does it hurt her? Yes, somewhat. Does it hurt her critically? No, I don't think so. And I think not only because Trump has a way of eclipsing other stories, but because the issues raised by the possibility of a Trump presidency are so serious, I think most swing voters are going to come around to realizing that however flawed Hillary Clinton's, you know, approach to her emails at the State Department were, and however flawed Hillary Clinton might be generally, is really eclipsed by, you know, the multiple dysfunctions of Donald Trump. That said, I've been wrong before, but I think she survives it.
That's an encouraging analysis. You know, you're so right about Trump having these multiple dysfunctions, and here he got served up probably his biggest home run ball of the campaign with the email server issue, and Hillary did the right thing. She immediately had a press conference talking about Donald Trump, and she was out there in Las Vegas yesterday about him using the whole going broke as a business strategy, not as a last resort when things go south, and talking about the real damage to people he hurt by using bankruptcy as a business strategy. But even with that, the big news is more Trump dysfunction. But given all that, I'm just amazed at how close the race is. I mean, both overall, where some polls show them either even or Hillary with a slight lead, but in polls like swing states, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, Michigan, Hillary and Trump seem to be neck and neck. How is it that given Trump's multiple dysfunctions, they're still so close?
Well, the real peril to Hillary and the Democrats is in the Rust Belt states. I actually don't see any way at all that Trump could win Florida. It just got too many Latino voters at this point. But if you're a former manufacturing worker in Pennsylvania or Ohio or Michigan or Wisconsin, you can reasonably feel abandoned by 30 years of Democratic Party policy. And if you just see no traction whatever for you on the Democratic side of the ticket, and here comes a guy who says he's going to not sign any Trans-Pacific Partnership and repudiate NAFTA and presumably permanent normal trade relations with China, though I'll believe that, you know. I actually don't believe he would do that, but, you know, that's what he's saying. And there's a certain appeal there. And the broader sort of appeal is kind of the screw you to the political establishment that has ignored generally, a lot of the downwardly mobile white working class, which is not the worst off group of people in the United States, but is the most downwardly mobile group of people in the United States. So it becomes certainly a possibility that she could lose some of those states. I don't think there's any way she'd actually lose Wisconsin. I would be surprised if she loses Michigan. But Pennsylvania, as well as Ohio, are certainly up for grabs, and Pennsylvania is a state the Democrats have won in every election since 1988. So that would be a real factor. Now, it should be said that the one issue that Bernie Sanders is determined to press forward on in the Democratic platform is a firmer rejection of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And how Hillary responds to that, and to a certain degree, actually, how President Obama responds to that, because it's mainly out of loyalty to Obama that the platform drafting committee majority didn't accept the Sanders language on that. That's a real issue. And, you know, the last thing Hillary Clinton needs is a floor debate at the Democratic convention on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, in which it's not stricken from the platform as something Democrats favor, or just even the debate itself. I mean, what are the proponents supposed to say? Are they supposed to get up there and say, well, it's better than our past trade deals, or are they going to get up there and say, which is certainly probably the case, well, I'm actually against this, but I don't want to embarrass our president. I mean, none of that is going to help her in Ohio and Michigan. So it certainly behooves her, a word I enjoy using, it certainly behooves her to try to get the Sanders language actually into the platform on this.
I think that's great advice. And we'll see what happens with that. That convention is coming up in just a couple of weeks now.
And the Democratic Platform Committee has its meeting tomorrow and Saturday. So that's coming up right away.
Right, and we know that with Bernie Sanders in the race, you know, Hillary had been for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is just terrible free trade agreement. She'd been for it when she was Secretary of State working for President Obama, but in the course of the campaign said she was now against it, and many people attribute it to the support Bernie got on that issue as he was campaigning.
Absolutely, and they should also attribute it to just the fact that it's a position that hurts her, even if Bernie weren't in the field. It should be pointed out that she has been moving towards Bernie positions on any number of issues, including very prominently yesterday, free college tuition at public colleges and universities for anyone from a family making less than $125,000 a year. She had opposed this position up until yesterday, and then changed it and supported it and worked it out in conjunction with the Sanders campaign. She had been proposing a range of proposals to reduce student debt, which are still part of her platform. She added this to it after sort of poo-pooing it throughout the primary process. So I think there's real convergence here, and no doubt it's part of a package in which Bernie will support her enthusiastically.
Right, and we need that to happen to have a united party to win in November. And now that Hillary is kind of undisputably the presidential nominee for the Democratic Party, who do you think she'll pick as vice president? You know, we've heard about Elizabeth Warren. We've heard about Senator Tim Kaine. Who do you think she should pick, and does it matter at all who she selects as her vice presidential running mate?
Well, it doesn't matter that much. I mean, historically, vice presidential choices may be hugely important should the president die in office, but it really doesn't affect elections very much. That said, I think Elizabeth Warren would certainly give her a boost with Sanders supporters and others. I think she'd be a popular pick. The logic for Tim Kaine is that he nails down Virginia, but I have trouble imagining her losing Virginia no matter what. And then, you know, there's the possibility that she might choose a Latino running mate, although the way Donald Trump has estranged Latinos, it's not clear how much more she needs to do to nail down that support. There is a field poll out today from California that shows her leading Trump among Latinos out there by, I think it's something like 78% to 12 to 13%. 78 to 13. I mean, you can't do much better than that. That's without a vice presidential running mate. So we shall see. I should add the field poll has her leading Trump overall in California by 30%, 3-0. So yeah, that's a pretty fair lead.
Wow, that's amazing. And we know there's a big Latino vote in California, so that plays in there. You know, it's interesting you mentioned about she doesn't really need Senator Tim Kaine on her ticket with her to win Virginia. She's got the governor of Virginia now is Terry McAuliffe, who's been very close to Bill and Hillary Clinton for decades. And he was running the Democratic Party when Bill Clinton was president. And, you know, I'm sure Terry McAuliffe, as governor in Virginia, will do everything he can to help Hillary win that state.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. One of the issues involved in picking a senator is whether that senator is running for re-election that year, and it's whether the state has a Democratic, a Democratic or a Republican governor. And if it has a Republican governor, as Massachusetts does, where Elizabeth Warren is from, and as Ohio does, where Sherrod Brown is from, the governor could appoint a Republican senator, and, you know, that Democrats really don't need to lose a Senate seat that way. One of the virtues of Tim Kaine, as you just pointed out, is that Virginia has a Democratic governor who would appoint a Democrat, so that's a plus one for Tim Kaine.
Right, that's true, although the other thing with Massachusetts, given it's my home state, I've watched this happen, the Massachusetts legislature has other times changed the rules in how the replacement senator is picked. So they changed it when Senator Kennedy died, and they could do it again. They'd be a little embarrassed maybe, but they might do it anyway to figure out some way that the Senate replacement is picked by someone other than the governor. But we'll see what happens. I don't know. I think a lot of people I know, a lot of progressives, think it's better for Elizabeth Warren to stay in the Senate and that she should keep her independent seat, her independent voice, her own power base, and that she would make a mistake to be vice president of Hillary and kind of give up her own power and have to just support whatever Hillary does, even if Elizabeth Warren doesn't agree with that. What do you think? Do you think it would be a good idea for Warren to be the vice president or not?
You know, there's a song by the old satiric songwriter Tom Lehrer entitled Whatever Became of You, Hubert, which has about Hubert Humphrey, who was the leader of the liberal faction in the U.S. Senate as a senator from Minnesota, then became Lyndon Johnson's vice president. I recall one couplet from that song, once a fiery liberal spirit, but now when he speaks, he must clear it. And that certainly has to be a factor with Elizabeth Warren. I would think if she were offered the vice presidential nomination by Hillary Clinton, she would need to negotiate terms. And among those terms, we know would have to be, since she has harped on this, rightly so, more than anyone else, some say over who is running economic and financial policy in a Clinton administration. Elizabeth Warren is the person who has said personnel is policy, meaning in essence you don't want another Robert Rubin protege at Treasury. And so I would imagine that she would have some preconditions for accepting the vice presidential nomination, and that would be on the list. But, you know, it would be a trade-off, and I would hesitate to predict how that might go.
Right. Well, we'll see how that plays out. We'll know in a couple of weeks. And you mentioned earlier in the show of the fact that Bernie Sanders has had an impact on Hillary Clinton and what she's campaigning about, that she's now, as of yesterday, come out for the free college tuition. She changed her position to now be against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is wonderful. In many ways, Bernie has made Clinton a better candidate, I think really improved her chances of winning. What are the other ways that you think Bernie has had an impact on Hillary Clinton?
Well, I mean, I think that's the main one. And, you know, if you look at the vote in the Democratic primary process this year, there has never before in the history of exit polling, which pretty much goes back to 1968, been a series of elections in which age was more determinative. Sanders won voters under 30 he won 71% of voters under 30. She won 72% of voters over 65. I mean, I think Sanders has alerted not just Hillary Clinton, but the entire Democratic Party, that there is the millennial cohort in American politics is distinctly left of previous generations, and that makes a lot of sense because they're like the generation of young people in the 1930s who have experienced a really dysfunctional economy. There was one indication of that that I found very striking. Someone recently did an analysis of census data and found that roughly a third of of people under 35 are still living with their parents, and that this is the highest percentage of such people still living with their parents since the government began collecting data on this in 1880. Now, I mean, it's great that young people love their parents, but this is clearly a question of finances. And, you know, you can love your parents and get the hell out of there is the normal response.
Right. And I would say from the parent point of view, we know that the parents love the children, but here's your hat, what's your hurry, time to move on.
Yeah. And, you know, you had at some point planned on using, converting that bedroom to some other use. So there's really been, I think, such a distinct generational profile that has emerged as a result. I mean, it was there anyway, but the Sanders campaign made it much more visible than it had been previously, and put Clinton and the whole party on notice. And, you know, if you're looking at why she suddenly changed her position on free college and public college university, I mean, you know, that really doesn't require levels of quantum mechanics to figure out. I mean, this is a hurting generation. And it's a huge generation. And so that's, I mean, I think that's one of the gifts Bernie Sanders has given to the Democrats is a clear understanding of what millennials need, what millennials want and expect from their elected officials.
I think that's exactly right. And Hillary's reading the tea leaves and reading the polls, and she's seeing that Bernie Sanders got that 71% of that vote under 30 years old. She has to do something to really attract them and get them engaged in her candidacy now that he's not in it. And free college tuition is a great first step. I'm also encouraged by that. I know some people don't like it when politicians change their position, but I actually think it's really a healthy sign that Hillary is showing she's willing to change and go where the people are, what she needs to do to engage the at least the vote, if not the enthusiasm of the American people.
Absolutely.
And what do you think is going to happen? You know, there was a big split. There was a turned kind of a little bit nasty at the end in the Democratic primary. Do you think the Bernie Sanders supporters will unite behind Hillary as the nominee, or do you think the youth will stay at home or maybe even vote for Trump because he's the candidate of change?
No, I mean, I think the polling is pretty clear that probably an overwhelming majority of Bernie Sanders supporters will vote for Hillary. I should add that he appeared today, apparently will be broadcast tonight, on Charlie Rose, Bernie did. And with still without formally endorsing her, he said, and I'm quoting, "We have got to do everything we can to defeat Donald Trump and elect Hillary Clinton. I don't honestly know how we would survive 4 years of Donald Trump as president." So look, I mean, he's moving. And mm-hmm. I think by holding out, he has won, you know, so many victories on issues that his supporters and he care about deeply, that it becomes an easier transition for most Bernie supporters to move to Hillary. You know, I mean, will there be some who, out of some bizarre calculation, decide to vote otherwise? I don't think the young people, even the ones who are, you know, determined not to vote for Hillary, they're not going to go for Trump because, you know, the politics of Bernie's young supporters are, you know, so anti-racist, and Trump is the most overtly racist major political candidate since, God knows, probably since before the abolition of slavery. Some of his older supporters might go that way. Some of the young men or old men who are for Bernie might go for the libertarian, though it's a bit of a stretch to go from Medicare for all to Medicare for none, which is, you know, what voting for a libertarian would signal. But I'm pretty confident that a good 80-some or maybe more percent of Bernie supporters will end up voting for Hillary.
That's encouraging. And and I'm hoping to see Bernie Sanders endorse Hillary soon. I'm not quite sure what the delay is. I mean, the numbers have been against him now for weeks.
I think he's waiting, you know, and he's trying to negotiate while he still has leverage. And I think her switch yesterday on free college tuition shows that this is a pretty fruitful approach. And I think, you know, the one remaining stumbling block is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because, you know, he knows that if that comes to a vote on the convention floor, not only are his delegates going to vote for his position, but there are going to be so many delegates from unions and environmental groups and members of Congress from the industrial Midwest who are going to have to vote on his side as well. So, look, he's got a lot of leverage still, and I think he's using it in a positive direction, and I don't really think that there's any diminution in the likelihood that his supporters are going to move away from Hillary that's affected by his holding out. I think winning these things is important in a certain way for bringing his supporters, you know, into the Clinton fold, actually. So I'm not really upset at all by the course he's taken.
I think that's true. And there may be, I don't know whether Bernie himself or someone in his campaign may have made a calculation waiting to see what happened with the email server thing. And if that had come the other way, if the FBI had recommended bringing charges against her, I mean, that could have been a fatal blow, or certainly a major damaging blow.
Oh, that would have knocked her out, I think. And yes, they were probably waiting for that, and they probably correctly thought that there would be no indictment, but they may as well wait around and see.
Right, exactly. And I'm glad that the FBI made its decision before the convention, so that's all clear.
I think they understood they had to. There was a limit to how much they could overturn the American political process. So I think Comey clearly understood that.
Right, that's encouraging. And we have the opposite here in the city of Washington, D.C., where the mayor, who had just been elected, became under a cloud and investigated for shenanigans in his campaign finance. And one after the other, about six of his campaign people were indicted and charged. But the mayor himself was still under indictment 4 years later when he was up for reelection. And that definitely contributed to his losing that mayor's race to Muriel Bowser.
Right, but was never indicted.
It was a cloud hanging over him. People were wondering, is he going to be indicted? So I'm glad that didn't happen to Hillary. And it'll be great when Bernie gets out with some enthusiasm behind Hillary. I mean, his support really matters. If you look at one of the key swing states, for example, is New Hampshire, even though it's small, with its four electoral votes, it's still one of the 11 or so swing states up for grabs in this election. Bernie won New Hampshire by 24 points, so he could really help Hillary there, and not just Hillary, but there's also, as you know, the Senate seat race running where the Democrat Maggie Hassan, the governor, is running to get the U.S. Senate seat away from Kelly Ayotte, the Republican, and two great progressive women running for Congress in New Hampshire, Carol Shea Porter and Annie Custer. So it would be great if Bernie Sanders turns on the juice in New Hampshire and helps excite the people there who voted for him to vote the Democratic ticket come November 8th.
I think he'll do that. I think we'll see a lot of Bernie on the stump for Hillary and other progressive Democrats between now and November.
Yeah, that's encouraging. I don't know if you saw the quote from Van Jones this week, well-known progressive analyst on CNN and elsewhere, where he said he thinks Trump could win due to the complacency of the left. Do you agree with that?
No. But I think it's enough of a threat that, we need to do everything we can to keep that from happening. I don't think the left is complacent. I think part of the left is disgruntled, and that needs to be dealt with. But I don't think in the face of Donald Trump, the left would be complacent. I'm more concerned about a fit of pique than a lack of interest. But we need, but I think progressives everywhere need to be really concerned about this election and work on our fellow progressives who are off in space somewhere on this.
Right. Well, and talk about a fit of pique. We just had a couple of weeks ago the vote in the United Kingdom, so-called Brexit vote, where the people voted to leave the European Union 52-48%. And a lot of people were shocked by that vote. And they, some of the people saying, oh, well, I voted to leave the European Union because I wanted to thumb my nose at the establishment and send them a message. I never really thought that we would vote to leave the European Union. And yet enough people did that they won. Do you think that the same strains of populism and national identity are running as deep here in the United States, and that might be the surge that elects Trump, president?
Well, it's running. It's certainly running as deep in parts of the United States, and those parts of the white working class in the Rust Belt that I alluded to earlier. Certainly, yes. The major difference, though, is our electorate at this point is only about 70% white, whereas in Britain it's still 90% white. So the numbers are significantly different on how much white nationalism can be generated here as opposed to Britain. But I mean, could it cost Clinton Ohio and Pennsylvania? Yeah. I don't think it'll cost her the whole election, but like I said, this is no time for complacency. But certainly, the sense of being left behind in a deindustrialized landscape is as strong in the Mahoning Valley in western Pennsylvania and eastern Ohio as it is in the English Midlands. Both of them, English Midlands and Western Pennsylvania, both incredibly strong Democratic strongholds from the 30s through the 80s, and then still Democratic strongholds for some time thereafter. But definitely turning in a more or less of a white nationalist direction now, after decades of basically being ignored by both parties' establishments.
Right. If you were advising Hillary Clinton, what would you advise her on the best way to beat Trump?
Well, first of all, let Trump be Trump.
Let him hang himself.
She has been blessed by the Republicans' choice of her opponent. That's very clear. She needs to do everything she can to mobilize the Democratic base, in particular minority voters. She needs to do just what she did, the kind of thing she did yesterday, to mobilize the young. She certainly needs to, move that extra couple of steps on trade. And she kind of needs to make, I think, I've been writing about this for about 4 years now, I think she kind of needs to do a sister soldier speech saying, the Democrats were wrong, we were wrong, about Wall Street and deregulation and trade agreements in the 1990s. Of course, the peculiar complexity is all of that went down when someone very close to her was president of the United States, her husband.
Right.
She needs to, I think, say we grew close to social forces who have been destructive in this country, mainly Wall Street. That did not serve the American people well. I understand that. Those were mistakes. We will not do that again. I think a bit of a sister soldier speech there would help, although given, as I said, her rather close relationship to the president under whom a lot of that went down, that's a harder speech to give than Bill Clinton's original sister soldier speech, which was not did not involve criticism of anyone in his nuclear family.
Right. Well, that's great advice. We'll see if she ever comes around to that. There's also, by the way, in this election, something we haven't seen really, I think, since Ross Perot in terms of third-party impact, although, of course, Ralph Nader had more impact than any of us wanted before in those races. But now we've got in the Libertarian ticket, Gary Johnson and William Weld, both former Republican governors, now running on the Libertarian ticket, and they're polling at 10% and when they're included in the polls. I just actually came out of a luncheon at the National Press Club with Governor Gary Johnson and Governor Bill Weld talking about why they think they could win, and they think it's if they get included in the debate, which they'll get if they get to 15%, that they actually might have a shot in a wild and crazy year where both candidates are have unfavorables over 50%. Do you think the Libertarian ticket is going to have any impact on this presidential race?
Well, I think the scenario they just sketched out is, to put it mildly, far-fetched. But they might have an impact around the margin. In theory, they should hurt Trump more. In the early polling, that's not clear. But, I mean, the fact is most third parties of the left or right see their support really shrink in the last 2 weeks of the campaign. You can ask President Henry Wallace from 1948 about that. I think Trump just makes this so much more of a high-stakes election that almost anyone can understand that, for better or worse. They can see how different he is from, what we might term, also for better or worse, normal presidents. I think the third-party vote will really decline towards the end. Now, if someone is in a state that is really very blue or very red, then it's kind of a free vote. So in Massachusetts, you might see the Green candidate do better than she otherwise would, because it would be assumed, that Hillary Clinton, really has it locked down. Same perhaps in California. In Texas, you might see more of a vote for the Libertarians, because obviously Trump is going to carry Texas. So around the margins, yeah, it'll have some impact. I would be in most of the swing states, though, just like a hanging concentrates the mind, I think a Clinton-Trump contest will so concentrate the mind that I would be surprised if either the Libertarians or the Greens do very well in swing states. On the other hand, as Ralph Nader demonstrated, if it's very close, you don't have to do all that well to affect the ultimate outcome.
Right, exactly. And I was surprised when asked about it that Gary Johnson, the presidential candidate for the Libertarians, said that the polls are showing now that they're drawing about equally from Clinton and Trump, although slightly more drawing from Hillary. So
That's what I've seen in the polls. On the other hand, I think when they say they're polling 10%, excuse me, that's a little high. I think it's closer to 5.
Interesting. Yeah. So if it's small, it may not matter so much. I was hoping that the Libertarians would draw more from the Republican vote for Trump, particularly given that both the Libertarians on the ticket are former Republican governors. And maybe over time that's what will happen. And they actually
it's a big leap. It's a big leap to go from, if you're a Sanders supporter, from Medicare for all to Medicare for none. So, as the election year wears on, I would expect that to change.
Right. And what do you think about with Trump as the Republican nominee? Do you think that increases the Democrats' chance to regain a majority in the Senate? Do you think the Democrats might take the Senate?
I do, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of Republican incumbents who have always cruised to re-election, Charles Grassley in Iowa being one example, who essentially are tied at this point. I do think the Democrats have a good chance to retake the Senate, and they certainly are likely to make gains in the House as well. Whether they can make a 30-plus seat pickup, which would be required for them to retake the House, still remains that's a little ambitious. I would be surprised to see that.
Yeah, good. Well, we'll hope we at least get the Senate, and then if Hillary wins, she's got some people who can actually vote to get a Supreme Court justice nominee put onto the Supreme Court.
I would think if the Democrats control the Senate but are nowhere near having 60 votes, that they would change the rules on filibusters on appointees to facilitate things like a Supreme Court appointment, even if there were only, say, 52 Democratic senators.
Right. Oh, that would be a smart move. You know, I'm just amazed that Republicans are refusing to hold hearings on the president's nominee to the Supreme Court. We've got a vacancy on the court now. But is that hurting them? I mean, I would think any reasonable American voter would just say these people are just so obstreperous and difficult and irresponsible that there's no way we should elect any more Republicans to the Congress.
Well, you know, I mean, at this point, Barack Obama's approval ratings have been a little over 50% now for the better part of half a year, at least. The congressional approval ratings are well below 20% for the last year and a half, and most of that is because of the Republicans. The problem is, you know, House districts tend to be so hard Republican or hard Democrat, often due to gerrymandering, that even when you know, have a majority wanting to get rid of that elected representative, you don't necessarily have a majority in that district because of the way the lines have been drawn and because of the geographic sorting by ideology, which goes on in this country, and by demographics as well. So folks, I mean, like, for instance, in the last set of congressional elections, if you add up all the votes for House candidates, say, in Pennsylvania, more people voted for the Democrats than for the Republicans. But then the Republicans still have a greater than 2-to-1 advantage in actually holding House seats in Pennsylvania, because of the way the lines are drawn. So the problem is, people can be totally disenchanted, and rightly so, with Republican control of Congress, but that doesn't mean Republicans lose control of Congress.
Right. We need to get the Democrats to get the governorships in order to deal with the next redrawing of the lines after the next census. So that's another year, another year's battle. And while we're talking about the Senate, what do you think? Do you think Maggie Hassan is going to be able to beat Republican Kelly Ayotte for the New Hampshire Senate seat?
Well, you're the expert on Upper New England, Eleanor, and I'm not. I mean, I think the polling at this point shows them about even, and that's always bad for the incumbent. And it's not a good year for Republicans generally, so just going on that rather than any specific New Hampshire intelligence, I would say, yeah, there's a good chance there. The Democrats have a good chance, in Illinois, and they have a good chance in Ohio, and they even have a pretty fair chance, I think, of unseating John McCain in Arizona, who Carolyn Kilpatrick is likely to be the Democratic nominee there. She is a member of Congress. And Arizona is a state that has had major demographic change to the point where it is certainly possible that Hillary Clinton could carry it. So, you know, we shall see. But there are certainly straws in the wind for Democrats really all over the place.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I hope that those Democrats do win those Senate seats. That would be fantastic. And I want to talk about your wonderful recent article in Dissent magazine about the future of the Democratic Party, which I thought was really brilliant. And I encourage our listeners to either buy a copy or go to the library and read Dissent magazine, Harold Meyerson's piece there. I think it's one of your best ever.
Thank you. I think it's www.dissentmagazine.com or .org, one of those,
to find
it online.
Could you summarize your key point for our listeners?
Well, I mean, the problem is I write so much, I'm not quite sure what's in what piece and what's in another. But I certainly talk about the generational shift in the Democratic Party, which I've already talk some about, and how that's really going to move the party to the left and reshape it. And I also talk about how parties change. You know, the Democratic Party has, in the 1920s, the differences between the two political parties were sort of cultural and geographic and ethnic. The Democrats were this crazy mix of immigrants in cities and white Southern racists, and therefore they fought with themselves a lot over issues like prohibition. But they didn't really have economics that distinguished them from the Republican Party. So much so that the party chair during the Herbert Hoover presidency, John J. Raskob, was the chair of the Finance Committee of General Motors and, generally speaking, the consigliere for the DuPont family, which was General Motors' largest shareholder, as well as obviously the owners, the owners of DuPont Chemical. And Roosevelt becomes president and has really a new electoral base, the rising labor movement, and moves so on economic policy that by 1936, Raskob has founded the Liberty League, which is the leading anti-Roosevelt organization in the country. So the Democratic Party makes a huge change then. It makes a huge change in 1964-65 under Lyndon Johnson. The change is the New Deal order is working very well. Prosperity is broadly shared except for, you know, minorities. And when you break them out of the family structure for women, and the Democratic Party turns its focus rightly and understandably to those left out of the New Deal arrangements, and passes civil rights legislation, voting rights legislation, Head Start, poverty programs. And that becomes the major focus of the party for the next 50 years. But there's a sort of assumption that the Lyndon Johnson era Democrats made, and it was not an unreasonable assumption, and that is, well, our economy is basically working, so we don't have to address fundamental economic questions. And they didn't. And that's been the Democrats' credo, work on those left out of the sort of New Deal era prosperity, and don't challenge fundamental economic arrangements because those are working fine. And that was true in 1964-65, more or less. It's not true any longer. And so the party has to make that kind of transition again, not to abandon its concern for minorities and those left out. And the list of minorities has now expanded from African Americans to Latinos to immigrants to certainly women to gays and lesbians and now to transgender people, and rightly so. This is nothing that anyone wants them, anyone in Democratic circles wants them to abandon. But they have to make a fundamental shift, as they did in 64-65, as they did in Roosevelt's first term, by adding to that the original assumptions of Roosevelt's first term again, not in terms of specific solutions, but in terms of understanding, as they understood in 1934-1935, that the fundamentals of the economy don't work. And you know, that's sort of the message of the Sanders campaign. It's the message of Elizabeth Warren. Excuse me. And it's a message that I think most elected Democrats now realize has to be taken very seriously, or they will not regain and hold power. They have to address economic fundamentals. They have to address worker rights with a seriousness that they've not had since the 1930s, really.
Right, and that's what Bernie Sanders spoke to, and that's where he really resonated, as you say, 71% of the young people going, yes, we need to have fundamental change in the economy and the society to make sure that they have a shot. I mean, these are kids, they're coming out with a huge debt from their college education with the prospect of never getting out of debt in their lives. So I think it's very encouraging there. But you also talk in that wonderful article in Dissent about, even though so many of the young people do know about this fundamental need to change the economy, and a very high percentage of them call themselves socialists even, but that we can't just count on the passage of time where these young people will kind of take over the party and do the right thing, that we need action now, and we need for Hillary to move, we need the current elected officials to move, and we need those Bernie Sanders supporters to be actively pushing their program of fundamental change in the economy now in order to make the changes that are needed.
Yeah, I mean, they're sort of, you know, ready to move when there's room for movement, and so that room for movement has to be created. I mean, to a certain degree, obviously, it was self-created. I mean, no one anticipated Occupy Wall Street. That was there was some initial planning going into that, but then it became the spontaneous activity of many thousands of largely young people, and to a certain degree, that was what the Bernie Sanders campaign was. I wrote about 4 or 5 months ago that he didn't so much create a new American left. He revealed it, but he also revealed it to itself. You know, I mean, he and everyone else associated with that campaign was surprised when he got as much support as he got. That's not historically, to put it mildly, been the lot of American socialists. You know, I mean, there was this sort of mutual surprise and gratification that, you know, messages that had been shunted to the side of American political discussion for the longest time suddenly were front and central. So you don't want to squander, to put it mildly, you don't want to squander a moment like that. And that's the moment we're in right now. Now, I should add to that one thing, which is that part of what we have to figure out, you know, is not simply a question of mobilization, but you know, this has got a lot of intellectual work that has to go into this. I mean, how do you build worker rights worker power, which then builds worker income? That's where worker income comes from. Ultimately, it's worker power. How do you build that at a time when traditional jobs are going by the wayside, and we're moving into more and more of a gig economy? And that's a real conundrum, which, you know, we have to get a lot of people to be thinking about. But but that's part of the larger picture. And the larger picture is, the moment is propitious, and enough folks have been mobilized so that there's a clear political force, and we don't want that to disband.
Right, and you're so right. You know, when you say don't squander the moment, you mentioned on a prior interview on this show that you thought Obama made a strategic mistake in letting the movement dissipate after he was elected. And we just have a half a minute left here, but do you think the left is going to be able to continue to build on the incredible energy of the Sanders campaign?
Well, it had better. I mean, part of that is a question of what Bernie Sanders will do with his amazing list of donors and volunteers, which includes millions and millions of people. Part of that is what organizations like People's Action and the Working Families Party will be able to put together. But a lot of these groups are, you know, talking to each other and breaking down silos and working on already planning for 2018 and then on a progressive agenda. So let us hope.
Let us hope. That's a great place to end it. And that's all the time we have. Harold Meyerson, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your interesting analysis.
Well, thank you, Eleanor.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.